Becca Ballant, one of Windham County's state senators and the president pro tempore, or Senate leader, of the Vermont State Senate, has announced she's a candidate for the U.S. congressional seat being vacated by Peter Welch, who plans to run for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Senator Patrick Leahy, who announced his plan to retire from the U.S. Senate after 8 terms in office. Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray has also announced she's running for the same congressional seat in the Democratic Party's primary, which will be held next August. If either is elected, they would be the first woman to occupy Vermont's lone seat in the U.S. Congress. Ballant was the first woman to serve as the state's Senate leader. We had a chance to have a conversation with Senator Ballant to find out about which issues she'll be emphasizing in her campaign.
Let me just start, I suppose, with the most blindingly obvious question is,
yes.
What prompted you to throw your hat in the ring at this point?
Yes, thank you, Andrew. Obviously, it is a decision that requires a lot of deep thought and contemplation. And so, you know, I'm really running because we are facing really enormous challenges, not just here in Vermont, but nationally. And we've got a situation where working families are continuing to struggle. The pandemic is not over. We are making little progress at the national level on climate action. And, you know, in a real deep sense for me, the future feels really perilous because our democracy itself is feeling at risk right now. It's feeling really fragile. And what I've come to realize through my work in the legislature is we can't tackle these really big challenges if we continue to remain so divided as a people. And I know that you cover the news a lot, you're deep in your community. We have some really deep and what I would argue is dangerous divisions that are going on right now, both in our state and in the country, and sometimes, frankly, even in our communities and our own families. So, you know, I really want this campaign to be about acknowledging that despite the darkness that we all see around us, that I truly believe that we can get to a better place. And so I want to bring my frame of bringing courage and kindness to my work, not being afraid of tough fights, but making sure that we're focused on fighting about the policies and not fighting people and dehumanizing them and demonizing them, which is where I feel like we're at right now as a nation. And so I'm hoping to bring my experience both as a teacher and a parent and a community member and the pro tem of the Vermont Senate, where we've also had to get a lot of things done, even though we may disagree. And I'm hoping that Vermonters will elect me to serve them in Washington. I feel really committed to doing the work, a continuation of the work that we've done here in Vermont that I know needs more attention at the federal level, and most specifically around affordable healthcare, Medicare for all, decoupling insurance from people's place of employment. I think we've seen that deeply in this pandemic, and lots of support for families, childcare, family medical leave insurance, and workforce development in a really deep way. I've seen that throughout Windham County and the rest of the state. And so I see this really as a continuation of the work that I've done, and just realize that we have much more to do at the federal level on these issues.
I want to talk to you further about the polarization and demonization you mentioned there, because that's been something that's been on my mind a lot lately. But before we go there, I guess I just wondered, in the shorter term, you'll be still the Senate pro tem in the coming session, which looks like it's going to be well, I guess they're always challenging, I suppose.
They are as challenging. You've got a lot of big issues. Yep.
The next year, you have sort of an interesting situation with the ARPA funds that are available to attack some of these problems like housing, childcare, broadband that I know you've already been working on. But how will it be balancing that responsibility with the realities of going out and campaigning and trying to establish your name recognition statewide?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And one thing I always want to let people know is I certainly would not be the first president pro tem to be running for a statewide position from that, you know, from that office. And that's true for the Speaker of the House as well. There's a lot of precedent. Of course, I would be the the first woman within the Senate to be doing that, but there is certainly a track record of people successfully running from that position. I'm part of a team in the Senate. I see myself really as sort of the team captain, and so much of the work happens because of the talent and the experience of the senators that I serve with. And we have a lot of experience chairs of committees, and I know that they are going to be singularly focused on policy and also making sure that we spend that ARPA money really wisely that you talked about. And, you know, frankly, Andrew, I was thinking this morning about how this is going to be a wild ride in so many ways, because we don't know what's going to happen with some of those other statewide offices. I certainly have heard rumors that perhaps some of the folks who are in those statewide positions right now may be stepping down, and certainly the lieutenant governor's position is now going to open up. So we are all going to have to work really, really hard together to keep focused on the policy when we're in the building and keep the campaigning outside the building. And I already met with the lieutenant governor about this exact thing, had a conversation with her when we were up for the special session a few weeks ago. And she agreed that we cannot have the campaign interfering with this work, especially when we've got hundreds of millions of federal dollars to spend wisely. And, of course it will be a challenge, but as you said, every single session is a challenge. And I love my job. I love working on behalf of Vermonters, and I trust that my team and I are going to be able to navigate this together.
So, getting back to that issue or point about political polarization, what would your approach be to them who are just very dug in on, well, we don't want Build Back Better, we don't want an infrastructure bill, we don't want all the other pieces that members of your party have been advocating for?
Right. So there's a couple different levels here. So to that last point that you made, absolutely, there is certainly a strong thread right now within the Republican Party, which is about obstructionism when it comes to President Biden's agenda. So it's important for me to be clear that I want this president to be successful. I think that plan that he has is critical for Vermont families. It's critical for the infrastructure investments that we need. And so my job will be, I think, representing Vermonters' interests, making sure that the president's agenda is not derailed. And part of what I think I can do well is really unite the different aspects of the Democratic Party itself. Now, to your point about folks across the aisle, I certainly have a track record of working with people respectfully across the aisle, finding the overlap. I certainly understand that in Congress, it's a much more toxic environment right now. But I want to tell you about, if I could, I want to tell you about this project that I've been part of for the last 6 months or so. I actually have a monthly meeting with Democrats and Republicans who are not all in here in Vermont. They're national leaders, not necessarily in politics, but in various aspects of the world of, you know, business and nonprofits. And we get together every month for an hour and a half to talk about how do we change the way that we are talking with each other and our constituents. And again, to this point of being able to disagree on policy without absolutely demonizing each other, making the other person out to be a horrible enemy. And I think about this a lot in terms of our own communities and families. Certainly within my own family, or my extended family, I know that there are people that do not support this president within my own family. There are people who certainly voted for Trump. And we cannot just write those people off because we have political disagreements, right? So even within our own family, you can't shut the door on them. But we also have to be focused, absolutely focused on the people that we're sent there to represent, which is our constituents. And I've seen Peter Welch and Senator Leahy in particular be very good about trying to find the overlap with their colleagues Even people who are on the opposite side of the political spectrum, and I intend to lead from that place. But I'm not naive. I know it's not easy, but I do know that when you approach the work being focused on delivering for your people back home and trying to take ego out of it, you will bring more people into the conversation. I've seen it happen in my own work. I believe that to be true.
And another schism that seems to be in play is also between quote-unquote progressive Democrats and mainstream Democrats, to the point where it seems like the messaging that comes forth is one of disarray and just sort of internal bickering. Would that be an area you'd also want to focus on, trying to be a bridge to unite
Absolutely.
Warring factions, if that's not too
firm? Yeah. I mean, I think there is... you know, there's a lot at stake right now, and there are sometimes disagreements over strategy, right? It's not so much, I think, but not often disagreement over policy, certainly some details, but it's really about strategy. And there are different strategies to be employed, you know, at different critical moments. And I think, you know, as long as, you know, I continue to want to show up for my constituents. And when I mean my constituents, I'm really talking about Vermont families and all their iterations, that when we keep that, you know, center of the conversation, it does help bridge the different factions within the party. You know, we always say that the Democratic Party is a really big tent, and I think that's a good thing. But I do think that our challenge will be there's a strong possibility that we will be in the minority after the midterms. And then we are going to have to get really clear on how we pull in the same direction together. I know it won't be any surprise to you, Andrew, to know that we are in a workforce crisis of gigantic proportions right now. And some people call it the big quit or the big resignation, right? We've had thousands of Vermonters decide to rethink their jobs. This is certainly impacting employers and nonprofit organizations across Southern Vermont, and most acutely with our restaurant hospitality industry and our medical facilities. And so a lot of the investments that we want to make in this upcoming session are around these issues, really looking at ladders for people to move quickly into jobs that are you know, available right now. We've got, I believe, last count, there were 10,000 positions right now in Vermont that were openly recruiting and posting on the Department of Labor's website. So we know the jobs are there. We know we need to provide families with an affordable way to get the training and the education to get into those jobs. And that's going to be a big focus of the work that we'll do.
Before I let you go, just one final question. Two issues that I think I'm sure you're concerned about, and I know you've addressed during your time in the legislature. Guns and abortion.
Yeah.
What will be your stance on those two areas going forward if elected to Congress?
So I think Vermont has been a really strong leader when it comes to reproductive liberty and really making sure that decisions about reproductive rights are made by individuals, their families, and their physicians. We really don't need to have lawmakers making decisions for individuals about what to do with their bodies. And so been a big champion of that at the state level. We'll continue to be a champion of that at the federal level. I think that in particular, the law right now in Texas that emboldens people to sort of become the reproductive Gestapo and spy on each other is completely and totally abhorrent, and it's antithetical to who we are as Americans. So I think that will definitely be something that I will continue to campaign on. And you know, we're at another critical point, I feel like, you know, with our conversation around firearms in this country. We continue to have these mass shootings. I think it is a fair question to ask, is it time to look again at an assault weapons ban at the federal level. And I know for some Vermonters who are deeply concerned about their Second Amendment rights, I understand that. We are not talking about impeding someone's ability to protect themselves, their family, or you know, to hunt. We have a very strong hunting culture there. But I do think it's time for us to really ask ourselves, is this serving us? Is this serving our children when more and more children are afraid to go to school because of what might happen in an active shooter situation? Now, these are not easy issues. These are not issues that would be passed easily within Congress. Certainly on a much more, I think, doable, manageable level, really looking to close some more of the loopholes around gun purchasing. And also something near and dear to my heart is really looking at the epidemic of gun violence when it comes to young men and older men taking their lives with firearms. Vermont is an outlier. We have a very high rate of suicide with firearms, and they're almost always men here in Vermont. And I feel like we need to be asking ourselves, you know, what are we getting wrong that we're not supporting these people around both their mental health challenges and gun safety? So not easy topics to talk about, but I am someone who really welcomes difficult conversations with people. That's the only way forward.
Well, Senator Ballant, thank you very much again for your time. I really appreciate that. And well, good luck out there on the campaign trail. And the primary
you,
is
Andrew.
When? August 9th, I think, or something like that?
It is. Yeah, I believe it is the 9th. It's definitely in August and towards the beginning. And I should have it, you know, in blazed into my head, but I don't yet. But yes. And because I think part of the reason why I don't necessarily know exactly the date, because we start voting earlier, right? A lot of people vote by mail. So the campaign season and the voting season will really start in earnest in getting people to turn out the vote in July. So thank you for your encouragement. And I know we'll talk again.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
Becca Ballant, a former middle school teacher, won her first political contest in a race for the state Senate from Windham County in 2014. She went on to become the majority leader in 2017 at the start of her second term. And then, in 2021, she was elected as the Senate pro tem, the top position in the Senate. We're also hoping to arrange a comparable discussion with Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, shown here when we interviewed her back in 2020 when she was running for Lieutenant Governor, and we look forward to presenting that. Meanwhile, for the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Once upon a time, in the not-so-distant past, community clubs of various kinds were an important part of the social and economic fabric of communities, especially smaller ones. Membership in organizations like the Rotary Club, the Lions Club, Kiwanis, Fraternal Order of the Eagles, or the Masons, just to name a few, were a mark of community engagement, networking, to use a modern-day term, and social standing. Such clubs still play an important role in their communities, if one that also may not be as visible as in the past. The connections between members are still important, as are the occasional events they sponsor or support. And over the past 2 years, the COVID pandemic has made the once routine and regular weekly meeting into a more challenging affair, one some groups now do via Zoom. To learn more about the roles of such community organizations in these changing times, we spoke with the leaders of three local organizations, Barbara Mensch of the Rotary Club, Pamela Nichols of the Lions Club, and Chris Conte of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, to have them describe their organizations and what they do nowadays.
So the Rotary Club right now is actively involved in youth exchange. One of the goals of Rotary is world peace, and in the youth exchange program they have throughout the world, students go from country to country for a year exchange in order to learn a new culture, a new language to take home with them, to understand that the world is really a very small place and we are all connected as humans and not as borders and governments and things like that. So Our youth exchange program has hosted students since 1987. Of course, this past year we weren't able to do so, but we're looking forward to continuing next year. And we host a student here, and we actually send students from our community out to the world as well. And that's something that we've been doing actively and continue to do so.
So, as we were talking, yeah. Rotary used to be a major presence in town, and I suppose in a sense still is, but what is your thought on how it could, what's the right word here, find that pathway back or whatever to being a club that's, you know, really deeply involved in the community and doing lots of stuff. Is that a scenario you see as possible, or given how different the times are now compared to 40, 50, 60 years ago?
Well, I think Rotary, the role it played 40 or 50, 60 years ago when they first were incorporated here in Manchester, was really a community building club. It built the pools, the playgrounds, it built the pavilions at the rec. It created carnivals for the town. Everything they did was about bringing the town together. And now those things are being overseen by other organizations like the Manchester Rec, and which is fantastic. Now we have to sort of think, what else can we do for the town that isn't being addressed? And our club right now is focusing on education. We are specifically putting some money and effort into literacy in our community. And we're hoping that by having that kind of goal, that people in the community will want to join that. Because I think almost everybody appreciates education and wants their own children to have access to education. So, you know, we're hoping that when people find out what we're doing, that they would be happy to not only contribute, but to also join in our group. Other things that Rotary is we're friends, and we have a good time together, and we enjoy each other's company, and we come from all sorts of backgrounds and careers and ages and families and locations. And we have this one thing in common, which is called Rotary. And we really, really want our community to thrive. And the motto of Rotary is service before self. And it's a wonderful sort of reminder when we get together and talk about what we want to do as a group, as individuals. But like I said, you know, we are a fun group, and we're hoping that as people move into this community, as people are trying to get to know each other, that they find Rotary as a place that they can come meet people and participate in improving areas that are important to us.
For the Lions Club, you know, in 1925, Helen Keller came to our convention and asked us to be her Knights of the Blind. So for Lions Club all over the world, we work on eyesight, glasses, surgeries. You know, there's clinics that go on in different countries. We collect eyeglasses that are recycled and go into other countries. We have the spot screener here, which is actually, some of the parts are made from Mac Molden Company. And in 15 seconds, you can read somebody's vision. And we go into the schools and every kid is numbered. So, because we don't want names or anything like that. It's all numbers. And we take their vision and it'll say fine or needs another exam or whatever. So, and it ends up being about 10% of the kids need to be referred. And just recently, there was a child found in Castleton who had something wrong with her vision. The parents had no idea. And if she hadn't had eye surgery within the next 6 months, she would have lost her sight permanently. So that gives you cold chills. And that's happened a few times for us. We had one when we first started with the spot screeners up in Barrie, who both of her parents were doctors. She was nonverbal. They just figured, you know, she was 3 years old and she'd come around and whatever, and ended up that she had a pretty serious, she really couldn't see at all and had to have eye surgery. And once she had her eye surgery and she could see, she started talking apparently like crazy. So, you know, there's things we can find and ways that we can help. Another big program we have is that our Vermont Lions Charities, which we all collect money for, gives money to parents of kids in Vermont. They're traveling to different hospitals for cancer treatment. So we give them, you know, money to cover their gas, maybe spending the night, maybe their groceries, whatever that is. And we've done, I think it was 18 families was the report this last week. So far this year, we've done 18 families. And it's a $500, you know, check for them to cover incidentals. But every club has their own thing. Like my club in Londonderry, we're all sewers. So we sewed over probably 6,000-7,000 masks through the pandemic and gave them away. We were taking them to the clinics, we were taking them to the schools, we were taking them. And then recently we've been sewing quilts and lap quilts and different things like that to take to people. So every club is different. Every club does their own thing. Now I know I was in Granville last night and they're getting ready to, because they're part of District 45, which is Vermont, they're getting ready to do Christmas shopping with kids in the area. They have 20 kids that they give the kids money to go and take them they used to take them shopping. Now because of COVID, the parent brings them and they get an envelope with cash and a calculator and they can go around the store and buy gifts for their family. That's quite a large thing for Granville. I mean, that's a considerable amount of money for them.
So why do you think it is that it's hard to kind of keep get new members to come in? I mean, is it just that, you know, younger folks are so busy and they got one thing or another going on, they don't have time for this sort of stuff? Or, I mean, I've heard that mentioned a couple of times.
Well, I think it's a club, and we've started to do this, and I keep suggesting this to clubs. You know, in the pandemic, we did Zoom. And everybody, we had more people showing up than we ever have at a meeting. So we continue Zoom. When we have our meetings, there are a few of us in person, but there's a few of us in Zoom. We have a few of us on FaceTime. So if they can't get to a meeting, they can just get on Zoom and be at the meeting anyway. And I think as a club, as we get older, we need to adapt to what, you know, the younger people do. I mean, they date, they meet their spouse, they get married. Basically, everything for them is technology. And we have not done that. So we have been really focusing and striving to get our clubs to use technology to make it easier for their members to come to the meeting and participate and feel part of the family. And then they come to activities and they help or they make suggestions. Or if they're not there, we don't get any of that.
We have about 250 members. That's, you know, every year they pay their dues. But in terms of active, you know, month-to-month participating members, we have around 20 full-time veterans. And then there's also the auxiliary, which is close to another 150 people. And that's people with family members who have served, brothers, sisters, dads, moms. So overall, probably over 300 strong.
That sounds like quite a few. Is that a high number for you, or is that about average?
It's about average for the state. You know, we are one of the larger posts in the state. I think, you know, Rutland and Burlington, they're obviously much bigger, and then there's smaller posts. But we're about typical size for the state.
So what is the mix of veterans kind of, what, going back to the Vietnam era, or?
Oh, we still do have some members from World War II alive and Korea. Most of them live in Florida these days, and we don't see them too often. But, you know, up until about 6 months ago, our active chaplain was a World War II veteran, but he just recently moved in with his family in New Hampshire for help. But a lot of Vietnam, a lot of Desert Storm, That is the big thing that kind of separates us from, say, the American Legion, is our members do have to be veterans of foreign wars, which makes recruiting a little bit difficult. We've got lots of members. A lot of people come in and want to join, and we wish they could, but unfortunately they don't qualify for some silly reason or not. But we make do, and they can always join the auxiliary.
So what would you say is, or how would you define, like, what the main role or mission of the club is? Is it to be sort of a social network for the veterans to kind of get together and hang out, or?
No, our main goal is to support veterans, not necessarily in a social club. You know, people do think of the VFW as the bar, as the club, but our main mission is to help and support through donations, charity, you know, serving in funeral details, assisting in local, you know, we do Christmas dinner every year. That's for the community, not just veterans, but, you know, much more than just a drinking place. That's what we try to get across.
So how would you say is that basically the way the club has been for the past 30, 40, 50 years? Is it, or has it evolved or changed or, you know, grown in some way over the past, let's say, 10 years or so into what you are now?
You know, back in the day, it was definitely many more veterans hanging around here socially. Nowadays, it's a lot more auxiliary members, social members. Us veterans are typically here for the events, the volunteering, organizing, you know, stuff like that. We're definitely many less veterans these days than there were 40, 50 years ago. So, we're struggling for membership.
Now, do you have a way of connecting with returning veterans or people coming back to the neighborhood, or is it kind of just a word of mouth thing where somebody knows somebody who's coming back into town?
It's a little bit of both. We don't have any formal way, you know, of tracking. We do happen to know who in the area serves in the military just because it's a small community. And when they get back from overseas, we reach out to them. We offer free memberships to active duty veterans who qualify and kind of get them while they're still serving, get them to join. And hopefully when they move home, they would want to, you know, continue to participate with the VFW.
So you mentioned earlier that you do lots of different activities. I think you have an essay contest. Yep. I seem to remember. I wondered, are there other kinds of sort of quote unquote community building activities like that you do, or?
We sponsor the local Boy Scout group, so we are directly affiliated with them. We're always doing, you know, they come and help out on Memorial Day, Veterans Day, when we do ceremonial flag burnings. They assist with that. If you happen to have a flag that needs to be properly disposed, you're always welcome to drop it off here at the club. We have the essay contest and the Voice of Democracy contest, both of which are through the elementary schools and the high schools, and those award scholarships. In addition to that, we have the just yearly scholarships we award to local seniors, about $2,000 each, just to a qualifying student in need. And then we also just have an unmet needs program. Any veteran who at any time needs anything, you know, if their heater blows, if their air conditioning dies in the middle of July and they just need a grant of $500, you know, they're a qualified veteran and they're in need, all they have to do is ask. And, you know, we always are pretty quick with a check, things like that. You know, we help out lots of people a lot.
There are more community clubs and leaders we'll hope to have future conversations with as we explore this evolving landscape. Meanwhile, for the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.